today on Against the Grain, the sociologist Michael Sukov believes that the crisis-ridden moment we're in requires a development of a radical political subjectivity. He thinks that the ideas of the Frankfurt School thinker Herbert Marcuse can help show us the way. I'm CS. Michael Sukov discusses a paper he's written entitled Herbert Marcuse, Radical Subjectivity and Climate Breakdown Toward a New Ecological Politics, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. The climate crisis is so vast, and efforts to address it appear so inadequate, that succumbing to helplessness and despair is a strong temptation for many. Which means that the psychological resources, and not just the rational acuity, of those working to combat climate change must be attended to. In other words, whether our feelings and emotions and instincts can stand up to the challenges that confront us is an issue of paramount importance. Herbert Marcuse, a German-born theorist associated with the so-called Frankfurt School, thought and wrote a lot about the psychic and what might be called libidinal dimensions of human existence. In this, he drew upon the ideas of Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and others. Michael Sukov believes that Marcuse's understanding of the relationship between reason and the emotions can help us in the current historical moment, 4 decades after Marcuse's death. Sukov, a sociologist, critical theorist, and scholar activist, believes that Marcuse's conception of radical subjectivity can inform the development of what we dearly need today, new or renewed forms of political agency and effective, much more effective, environmental activism. Michael Sukov is working on a book about Herbert Marcuse, and he shared with me a paper he's written that will become part of that book. The paper has the title Herbert Marcuse, Radical Subjectivity and Climate Breakdown Toward a New Ecological Politics. When Michael Sukov joined me recently in studio, I began by asking what he meant by subjectivity.
I guess I'd take several different angles on that. One simplistic version would be on the level of the individual consciousness. Now, that could be interpreted philosophically or even psychologically, depending on which way you want to go. For the purposes of my work, although I don't emphasize this latter concept in here very much, the notion of agency, subjectivity, and this is true philosophically as well, is very closely linked with agency, at least in the sense of political agency. It has to do with the capacity and ability or potential of a human being to think and act according to their thoughts, their feelings, etc.
You believe that this historical moment requires that we develop and cultivate a radical subjectivity. What do you mean by radical in this context?
Well, I mean by radical two different but related things. One, the original meaning of the word radical comes from a Latin term, radicalis, and was later, it came into English, and it basically was had the meaning of going to the root of something. So in the sense I'm using it in talking about Marcuse and this paper, I'm talking about going to the root of any issue or problem that human beings face. In the terms of this paper, most importantly, going to the root of the problems posed by climate breakdown and nuclear weapons proliferation or the potential actual use of those weapons. The other thing I would emphasize about the concept of radical as it relates to subjectivity goes back to Karl Marx. In a letter he wrote to a gentleman named Ruge, I don't recall the exact date, Marx talks about the ruthless criticism of everything existing. And in that context, he was talking about German and European politics in the middle of the early to middle of the 19th century. And he was making the point that philosophers, it was their responsibility to go to the root of problems. In other words, this radical criticism of everything existing for Marx was a vital task that philosophers, or at least those who are interested in human liberation, needed to engage in.
You referred to the climate crisis and to the dangers of nuclear weapons. Are those two of the principal reasons why, in this historical moment, you think radical subjectivity needs to be developed?
Yes. Those two global issues or problems are the most prominent, the most urgent ones, in my opinion, but not to the exclusion of other global problems and issues. The problems that 21st century capitalism and the planet face are all interrelated. And it's my contention, and I base this in Marcuse, that we need to get to the roots of those problems and look at how they're interconnected before we can proceed to both continue to diagnose those problems and come up with possible solutions to them.
Karl Marx wrote that humans are natural beings endowed with natural powers. What did he mean by that?
He meant that human beings are part of nature, and as such, they have natural powers, meaning the vital powers that are endowed to them through nature. And those powers include the capacity to act, to live, to express themselves. And those natural powers also include natural endowments that we now might refer to as instincts, at least on the psychological level.
And what are instincts, or how would you define them?
Well, this is a little tricky because in using that term in this paper, I'm not defining them in a vacuum. My definition is coming out of the Freudian tradition via Marcuse. But what I found extremely interesting was in reading Marcuse and through him Marx, that Marx himself, at least in the English translation, used the term instincts. So I guess the way I would describe instincts, they include urges, natural urges, to a certain extent feelings, but they're capacities or emotional responses that we're endowed with as human beings, although the expressions of those natural endowments or emotions or feelings are shaped by society, for Marx, first of all, and thereby for Marcuse.
What about reason and rationality? Are you talking about instincts here as something apart from or something diametrically opposed to rational thinking?
The term instinct, at least in its English derivation and in the sense in which Freud seems to use it and by extension Marcuse, has to do with biological urges that are rooted in the human organism, things such as hunger, sexuality, aggression. So they're basic biological urges or needs in the sense that I'm using it in the first instance. But it gets a little bit tricky, especially with Marcuse, because he wants to expand that definition on the one hand to include some not new, but aspects of the human biological dimension that Freud didn't necessarily emphasize or pay attention to.
So, yeah, and we're going to talk more about Marcuse's conception of instincts and desire and aggression. What did Karl Marx think humans needed to do with their natural powers or instincts in order to meet their basic survival needs?
Marx believed that human beings need to use those instincts or those capacities to survive, to shape the world around them, to feed themselves, to clothe themselves, to do everything that was necessary in terms of human survival. However, it's important to understand that human beings meeting their survival needs did just not happen willy-nilly. Human beings had to suppress, according to Freud and by extension Marcuse, certain aspects of those needs that would not enable survival. For example, if human beings have a desire for pleasure or sexuality, and that was all they ever expressed and acted upon, they would soon not be able to feed themselves, clothe themselves, or even engage in types of social interaction that were necessary for their collective survival.
So Freud, he believed that humans had to repress their instincts in order for what? For human civilization to be possible?
Yes, absolutely. He didn't think that human beings could survive in the natural world, in their environment, without doing that for the very reasons I already stated. So Freud believed that a certain amount of repression of instinctual desires was necessary.
Michael Sukov is his name. He's a sociologist, critical theorist, and activist scholar. And he's working on a book about Herbert Marcuse, Critical Theory and Contemporary Environmental Politics. My name is C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what did Marx think would happen to the amount of labor required of people, of workers, as capitalist development proceeded?
Well, Marx, first and foremost, had a historical view of the development of human societies. He talked about different periods or stages of societal development. I won't go into these right now. But his basic argument was that with the advance of labor, with technological improvements, with advancements in the organization of labor, that labor would become more productive. In other words, workers would be able to produce goods or services in a more contemporary context more efficiently, and therefore within the development of a particular society as a whole, if these developments or these improvements in technology and labor organization continued, there would be less labor that would be necessary on the part of laborers in order to meet that particular society's collective survival needs and even beyond that.
So for Freud, how important was it that the suppression or repression of instinctual energy or drives be minimized so that people's instincts could be expressed and enacted?
This was not really very important for Freud at all. The furthest he went was in a quote that I don't have right in front of me now, but it's a quote from Freud's The Future of an Illusion, where he indicates that a certain amount of repression is necessary in all societies in order for the goods to be delivered and for human civilization to meet its needs. However, he adds an important caveat to that, which Marcuse strongly picks up on. I can get to that later, where he says something to the Freud says something to the effect of the extent to which a given society requires a certain amount of repression and therefore allows the balance of the workers' time to be engaged in free creative activities is something that each society or each capitalist class has to determine for itself. And interesting, that's the point that Marcuse picks up on in the sense that he's showing that in Freud himself, there was a sort of ambivalence about the extent to which the kind of repression that Freud argued was socially necessary for civilization really needed to stay at a certain level, or whether or not it could indeed be reduced in order to truly fulfill the needs of human beings in society.
Well, you've referred a lot to Marcuse, so before we dive deeper, any deeper into his ideas, let's get out some basics about Marcuse. How would you describe, you know, kind of in a nutshell, who he was and how important a thinker he was?
Herbert Marcuse was a German Jewish philosopher and social theorist. He was born in 1898 in Germany, grew up in Berlin. At a certain point, he became a student of Martin Heidegger, who was a very important German philosopher of that time. Marcuse studied with Heidegger, I believe, in the mid to late 1920s. And Heidegger's work had a profound influence on Marcuse. On the other hand, Marcuse was a political activist. He fought in the German army during the First World War, and after Germany lost the war, he became a political activist. He was involved in the aborted German Revolution of 1919, and apparently that radicalized him, even more so than he had been before. I don't recall the exact point at which he started studying Marx, but the point is that by the early 1920s, when Marcuse became a student of Heidegger, he was also becoming exposed to Marxist ideas. And at a certain point in that development, which I believe was the late 1920s or early 1930s, I'm skipping a lot of history here, he became part of what later became known as the Frankfurt School, or critical theory. So Marcuse was part of a group of primarily German, but not only German Marxist philosophers, economists, sociologists, who were developing a new kind of critique of capitalism that went beyond Marx, but was rooted in him, but was also rooted in ideas of Freud and cultural criticism and all kinds of other variants of thinking at that time.
So how focused was Marcuse on the question of why, after World War I, the working classes had not successfully staged and prosecuted revolutions?
Well, the first point to be made in that regard is this wasn't something unusual for Marcuse. These were questions that were being asked on the left, again, in the wake of not only the failed German revolutions, but there were other aborted or failed revolutions in other countries in Central and Western Europe. And those thinkers who were Marxists began to ask the question of, well, why did these revolutions fail? Some of those theorists who generally now go under the rubric of Western Marxists, people like Georgi Lukács, Karl Korsch, a few others, started to theorize that there was another dimension to this problem beyond just the typical Marxist explanations of why revolutions fail. Some of those explanations were based on, you know, political decisions and political mistakes that were made by the existing leftist parties, that the forces and relations of production coming from Marx, in other words, the capitalist mode of production, hadn't sufficiently matured to the point where Marx really argued that these advanced societies would be ripe for a revolutionary movement. But these Western Marxists thought there was a deeper issue involved. And I'll also mention Wilhelm Reich in this regard, although he wasn't an official member of the Frankfurt School. At one point, he very closely worked on some of the same issues that they were involved in. And the point is, the Frankfurt School and Reich, and including Marcuse at a certain point, wanted to look into the psychological dimension of why, when workers are organized and join political parties and have these movements and even get to the brink of bringing about a revolution or even momentarily succeed in challenging the capitalist class, that the revolution seems to fall apart or backtrack or just outright fail. And this was an important question for the Western Marxists. And Marcuse, in his work, very much picked up on this question, along with the other Frankfurt School theorists that I mentioned earlier.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Michael Sukov joins us. He's a sociologist, a critical theorist, activist scholar. His PhD dissertation was titled Political Activism and Deferred Agency. And we are talking about a paper he wrote and he has presented about Herbert Marcuse and radical subjectivity in the context of climate and other crises. So in Marcuse's view, how had Western capitalist societies been able to gain and retain the consent and loyalty of their populations?
Well, first of all, his take on that would be that those societies have delivered the goods. In other words, the organization of societies based on the capitalist mode of production and the organization of the workplace and their ability to exploit and therefore profit from the wage labor of workers enabled them to produce the commodities and the other objects and services that enabled capitalist systems to not only survive but thrive and meet the basic needs of their population.
Yeah, and so people will then, of course, be less likely to be irritated, to be annoyed, to be upset with the status quo.
Correct. However, there was another important and perhaps deeper dimension to what Marcuse thought about what continued, and I would think he would argue continues to this day, to sustain advanced capitalist societies in their current forms of organization. And that is, on a psychological and cultural level, Marcuse argued that, well, he argued many things. On the one hand, he argued that not only was the capitalist mode of production able to deliver the material goods to meet the needs, survival needs of his population, beyond that, it was able to meet other kinds of needs that weren't necessarily part of what human beings needed to physically survive. Of course, in their most modern forms of expression, I'm talking about the culture industry, entertainment, movies, cell phones. Of course, none of these forms of technology were extant or even in the realm of possibility at the time that Marcuse wrote, much less at the time that he died. But nevertheless, his argument was that capitalism is able to manufacture needs so that people can be encouraged to purchase, to buy other kinds of goods and services that they arguably don't need for their physical survival. So this was a crucial argument, not only for Marcuse, but in the context of the Frankfurt thinkers as a whole. They had a whole critique of the culture industry, of different forms of entertainment. For Marcuse, this provided a cultural, psychological basis for getting workers and citizens of these capitalist societies to buy in even more deeply with the existing organization and production and therefore of society.
Yeah, reading from your paper, they are, in other words, getting the population to internalize the needs and requirements of the system. So let's talk about what Marcuse felt would or might happen or did happen to instinctual life under capitalism. Did Marcuse believe the repression of instinctual drives and energies was necessary under capitalism, was necessary in order for capitalist systems to function normally?
Well, again, I'd give a two-part answer to that question. Yes, Marcuse, the Frankfurt theorists, and even Marx did believe that a certain amount of instinctual repression was necessary in order for human societies to survive, to grow, and develop. On the other hand, you know, we have the issue of how much repression, instinctual repression in this case, is necessary in order for those societies to continue to grow and develop technologically, socially, culturally, etc. Now, that is the point at which both Marcuse and the other members of Frankfurt School argue that there is a certain amount of socially necessary repression, but beyond that, workers are being forced to, in a sense, repress themselves in order to continue to maintain the existing mode of production. But what I just stated is not something that's necessarily or at all self-evident to those individuals. And that's another point at which the function of ideology comes in for both Marcuse and the Frankfurt School to talk about what some of the barriers were and are to those individuals, you know, workers or citizens, to actually realize what's keeping the system going and what they're contributing to it in terms of surplus labor.
Did Marcuse believe that at a certain point of economic and technological development that people can be, in a sense, freed up, maybe because they need to labor less, to use their creativity and to engage in meaningful activities, meaningful to them?
Yes. The key word in the phrase you just used was can. Marcuse recognized the potential for this. And this is a very important point, because the other side of his argument is, so he's arguing two things. On the one hand, capitalist society and its further technological development makes it less necessary for the majority of people to spend the bulk of their working hours or their daytime just being producers and being laborers and being exploited. On the other hand, Marcuse is arguing, and again, this relates to Marx, but Marx, I don't think, talks about this as explicitly. The more efficient the mode of production becomes with the advance of technologies, improvements in the way the workplace is organized, etc., it's no longer necessary for workers to work as much as they are, but there is the potential for releasing them or more of their daytime waking hours to pursuits that have nothing to do with the workplace or with producing surplus value or producing needed goods and commodities.
Michael Sukhov is his name, S-U-K-H-O-V. He's a sociologist, a critical theorist, and an activist scholar. He's currently working on a book about Herbert Marcuse, Critical Theory and Contemporary Environmental Politics. We'll take a short break and speak more with Michael. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Michael Sukhov joins me. He's a sociologist who's done a lot of work on and around the ideas of Herbert Marcuse, a political philosopher, part of the Frankfurt School of Thinkers. He's written about a number of other things, including E.P. Thompson and Theory, and that article was published in the journal Socialism and Democracy, but we're focusing on a paper that he wrote and that he has presented at various conferences. It's entitled Herbert Marcuse, Radical Subjectivity and Climate Breakdown Toward a New Ecological Politics. You write, Michael, that according to Marcuse, there are available to societies like ours alternative conceptions of the relationship between reason and the instincts. And one of these alternative conceptions is characterized by what Marcuse calls sensuousness. What does he mean by sensuousness?
By sensuous, in my reading, Marcuse is talking about at least indicating something that could look like an integration of reason and the instincts. I don't know what the original German term was, and that's something I want to explore more in my further work on this subject. But from what I understand from my reading of Marcuse, sensuousness is a quality or a set of qualities that's rooted in human beings as sensuous beings, as feeling beings, and to a certain extent in their human nature or their biology, if you want to go where Marcuse takes it later on. But sensuousness also includes a cognitive capacity to think about the world, analyze our surroundings. And this is an argument that Marcuse makes in one of his earliest works, at least as far as his post-World War II works, which was Eros and Civilization, which was published in 1955, where he was looking for a form of reason that could be sensuous and, conversely, a form of sensibility or instinctual aspect of humans that would also have a cognitive or rational component.
And what attracts you to this idea? Do you feel like certain conceptions of subjectivity have been focused too much on the reason and on rationality and rational thinking?
Absolutely, C.S. Although, it's not a question of emphasizing one to neglect of the other. Both are important. What I've seen over the course of my research and just living in this society is that, on the one hand, the Western tradition, and particularly aspects of the Western philosophical tradition, have been very focused on reason as almost sort of an abstract capacity of human beings. I mean, reason or rationality does involve cognitive abilities to think, analyze, evaluate, and so forth. So that is an important part of who we are as human beings. And I respect that. And part of the other work I've done has been with the work of Jürgen Habermas, because to a certain extent, while Habermas indicates both of these aspects of Marcuse's work, his later work on communicative rationality and some of the other things he's written related to that seem to be missing that psychic or sensuous or psychological dimension that I think is so important, especially now, for us to develop a more grounded, integral concept of what human subjectivity is.
Marcuse used the term libidinal rationality, and I know we're throwing a lot of words and big terms at our listeners, but, you know, libidinal rationality is that kind of new form of reason for Marcuse that is not repressive of the senses, but acts in harmony with the senses. What did Marcuse think would happen if enough people developed this kind of integrated reason, senses, mindset, or framework?
Well, Marcuse, as a critical theorist and a Marxist philosopher, would never argue that individual changes in consciousness among a larger number of people would automatically lead to some qualitative change in society. Marcuse believed that at a certain point in the development of a capitalist society, such as the one we live in now or the one he wrote about in the 60s and early 70s, that several things would happen. Number one, there would be the growth and development of technology to enable more efficient production and therefore theoretically make available more free time to workers. But there would also be, and this is why I think and where I think Marcuse's work on ecology is so suggestive for today. Marcuse was talking about the ecology crisis back in the mid to late 1970s. And what Marcuse saw the potential in was in radical social movements, and the ones that he wrote about, you know, beginning with the 60s, the counterculture, the anti-Vietnam War movement, and later into the early 70s, the feminist movement, and then the ecology movement. He saw the potential in those movements for there to be not only an individual, but a more collective expression of that integration between the psyche or the senses and rationality. So it wasn't, for Marcuse, it wasn't just a question of a cumulative advance in the number of people who had some kind of a new consciousness. There was a dialectical process going on there, not only within those individuals, but between changes in individual consciousness and developments in the larger society.
Well, you know, it's one thing to talk about senses and feelings and instincts and desire. What kinds of feelings was Marcuse thinking needed to be integrated with reason or rational thinking? I mean, at one point in your paper, you talk about compassion. Was compassion one of those feelings, and what other kinds of senses might have been important for Marcuse in the sense of what radical social movements needed to have as part of their psychic fuel?
Now, this is a very important point about compassion, and I refer in my writing to a story that Jürgen Habermas recounts when he was basically at Herbert Marcuse's deathbed, and he had all kinds of wires and other kinds of machinery attached to him. And Marcuse, in that state, and he had had a stroke by that point, and he wasn't even able to speak as fluently in English as he had before. And by the way, Marcuse always spoke in English pretty much after he left Germany when the Frankfurt theorists fled the Nazis. Marcuse said something in reference to a conversation that he and Habermas had had 2 years before. And that conversation had to do with a moral component to critical theory. And in picking up on that on his bed in this, what eventually was a terminal situation for Marcuse, Marcuse said something like the following: "Look, I know wherein our most basic value judgments are rooted, in compassion, in our sense of the suffering of others."
Acknowledging the suffering of others. So Marcuse felt that that was essential to radical subjectivity, that that consciousness and that feeling in relation to other people's suffering was vital, was essential?
Well, not exactly. And this is where I'm, in a sense, trying to take Marcuse beyond what he actually said. And that's part of what this whole project involves. Marcuse, in talking about the instincts in his earlier work, never, as far as I can find, talked about compassion per se. However, I thought it was very interesting that on his deathbed, he made this statement. He came up with this insight, which does very much connect with some of what the other critical theorists, especially Adorno, have stated in their work. But I guess my point is that in Marcuse's earlier work, leading up until this moment on his deathbed, his notion of radical subjectivity and therefore of some kind of integration of sensuousness and rationality was focused more on the libidinal dimension. In other words, on the sexual instincts, on what he and following Freud called the life instincts. So I'm making kind of a leap here, more an indication that there was more to, or could potentially be more to, Marcuse's notion of radical subjectivity than simply rooting it in a libidinal dimension, in the instincts, or even in the life instincts. That an unexplored component that I would like to take further is, what is the relationship of a human, if you don't want to call it instinct, a motivation for compassion, fit in with a radical subjectivity?
Michael Sukov joins me in studio. He is a sociologist and critical theorist, and the manuscript that we are discussing is entitled Herbert Marcuse, Radical Subjectivity and Climate Breakdown Toward a New Ecological Politics. So bringing the life instincts into this, I mean, that is a kind of a psychological concept or phenomenon, and yet Marcuse was obviously very interested in changing the world, in political action, collective political action to change the world. So what link do you see him making between the drive for personal liberation and the political activity of trying to achieve some kind of social transformation?
First thing that I think we need to understand in understanding Marcuse is that this notion of the life instincts came out of Freud. And for Freud, the life instincts or libido, in Freud's own work, at a certain point, did not just have to do with sexuality or procreation or sexual desire. It had to do with what Freud called an aim-inhibited thrust of libido or of libidinal energy. And what he meant like this was that libido, when sublimated or taking different expression than just outright the need for pleasure or sexual satisfaction, had the potential for building relationships among human beings that were not simply or even libidinal in the sexual sense, but had something more to do with creating greater unities among people. Marcuse picks up on this. In Marcuse's last writings, which was called Toward an Ecological Society, which was actually a talk he gave in early 1979 to a wilderness class in California, he returns to some of the themes he discussed much, much earlier, as in Eros and Civilization, about the life instincts, about libido and aggression. But the point Marcuse made in that talk was that the life instincts or libido are not disconnected from who we are as natural beings. And in that, he was partly going back to Marx. In fact, in a very important way, going back to Marx, in the sense that Marx saw human nature as part of nature writ large. So Marcuse, in using Freud's concept of the life instincts, very much takes up that theme in talking about the environmental crisis or the ecology crisis that was just starting to be acknowledged and acted upon in the 1970s. And this is where Marcuse's work, I think, is very, very suggestive for the problems we face today, in the sense that Marcuse was making this link between individual instincts, life instincts. In other words, those things or those aspects of human nature which derive from the biological realm, and a broader concept of instinct, although I think at a certain point that term becomes a liability, but a sense of who we are as human beings that connects up with who we are as natural beings. If Marx and by extension Marcuse are right in linking up human nature with external nature, then it seemed to Marcuse, and it seems to me, that part of what we need to really radically address the climate crisis and the threats we face to our environment and ecology is we need to look at our own natural, instinctual, biological dimension and how that is not separate from what's happening to the nature around us.
Okay, so informed by what you have learned from Marcuse, what new forms, if you think new forms are required, what new forms of expression and activism need to be developed and cultivated in the current historical moment, given the threats that we and the planet face?
We need to be doing more work in small groups. And when I say small groups, I mean a type of small group that, to my knowledge, has not existed very often in the context of movements or social change, although I'm sure there are many I'm not aware of. I'm thinking something like the affinity groups that were formed in the late 70s and early 1980s around resistance to nuclear power. Specifically, the Livermore Laboratory in California. At that time, there was a strong anti-nuclear movement, which also was connected to the more general anti-nuclear movement of the late 70s and early 80s. And we had organizations of expressions like the Nuclear Freeze Movement and SANE and groups like that. But in California, what I'm talking about is what was called the Livermore Action Group. And they had a bunch of affinity groups, which were small groups of people. And so the affinity group, to me, is a very important and potentially very important expression of what a new form, or at least a building block of the new forms of environmental activism, needs to draw upon. And I'm talking something like a small group of people in face-to-face interaction based on consensus decision-making. But I would add another component to it. In the early 1980s, I myself was part of something that was similar to an affinity group. What we called it at the time was a personal political support group. And what I found that was very interesting and powerful about that group is, you know, we met perhaps once a week, never more than perhaps four or five people, although it could have gone to a larger number. We talked about the nuclear weapons threat, primarily, what was going on with that. But we also integrated into that our own personal feelings, fears, hopes around what we felt we could or couldn't do about that issue. And so for me, that added a very important component, which I think is something that Marcuse is also hinting at, although he doesn't say it in quite the same way. There needs to be within this affinity group structure or a structure of small groups a way of making connections between us as human beings and us as political activists and thinkers. In other words, in order for us to more effectively address the problems we're facing, and they're enormous, climate breakdown and nuclear weapons proliferation are just two of the more urgent ones. We have to have a way of bringing our own being into the discussion. In other words, we have to have a way of integrating our own psyches, our own psychological dimension, into our analyses of the problems we're facing. These can't be separated, because one of the big problems with addressing issues like climate breakdown or even nuclear weapons is people feel hopeless, disempowered. And that was the most powerful thing about this affinity group-like experience I had. It enabled me to bring in all my fears, concerns, feelings of hopelessness, but to talk about them in communication with others who felt similarly or sometimes differently. And that in and of itself was an extremely empowering experience for me. I think that kind of a prefigurative form of activism, integrating that with addressing some of the issues that we're facing now, particularly climate change, it must be a personal issue. Because if we don't make it a personal issue, we're not going to do anything about it. It has to become a personal issue, whether you want to call it an instinct or a need or a sense of compassion. That I see as the dimension that's largely missing from existing forms of ecological politics. Again, not to criticize those forms, but I think there's a missing dimension that's vital if we are going to have any hope of survival.
So psychological process, interpersonal connection, being authentic with one another, that is key to successful activism and keeping people's hope alive and keeping people's energy sustained.
Absolutely. And these small group structures have to connect up with each other as part of a larger movement. I don't have a whole blueprint for this laid out, but this whole project that I'm going to continue with is something that Marcuse adds a very strong political dimension to. But not only does he do that, he points the way towards what integrating these psychological dimensions of human existence and nature might be in a way that I think lend themselves to precisely developing the kinds of more concrete experiential structures that we need to develop as part of a movement like this.
Michael Sukov, he's joined me in studio. He's a sociologist, critical theorist, and activist scholar. He's currently working on a book about Herbert Marcuse, critical theory and contemporary environmental politics. We've been talking about a manuscript which he'll work into that book. Michael, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, C.S. It's been a pleasure.
And Michael Sukov can be contacted at this email address, hawaiiiscalling@gmail.com. That's hawaiiiscalling, all one word, @gmail.com. And in the time we have remaining, I have for you a brief excerpt of a talk given in 1962 by Rachel Carson, the ecologist and scientist whose book Silent Spring, published in 1962, helped forge environmental consciousness and spark the modern environmental movement. Here's Rachel Carson discussing how her book Silent Spring was received.
Another reviewer was offended because I made the statement that it is customary for pesticide manufacturers to support research on chemicals in the universities. Now, this is just common knowledge, and I can scarcely believe that the reviewer was unaware of it because his own university is among those receiving such grants. But since my statement has been challenged, I suggest that any of you who are interested make a few inquiries from representative universities, and I am sure you will find that the practice is very widespread. In fact, a visit to any good science library will provide the evidence, because it is customary in technical papers for the authors to acknowledge the source of their funds. Just an example or two gleaned at random from the Journal of Economic Entomology, a paper from the University of Wisconsin carries the note, "This research was also supported in part by grants from the Shell Chemical Company, Velsicol Chemical Corporation, and Wisconsin Canners Association." Another paper from the Illinois Natural History Survey declares this investigation was sponsored by the Monsanto Chemical Company of St. Louis, Missouri. A penetrating observer of social problems has pointed out recently that whereas wealthy families once were the chief benefactors of the universities, now industry has taken over this role. Now, of course, supportive education is something no one quarrels with, but this need not blind us to the fact that research supported by the pesticide manufacturers is not likely to be directed at discovering facts unfavorable to the continuance of current practices.
That's Rachel Carson giving a talk in 1962 to the Women's National Press Club in Washington, D.C. That audio comes from a From the Vault documentary produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives. And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.